Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Welcome back to Two Judgy Girls. I'm Mary from the Bay.
And I'm Courtney from LA. TJG is the podcast where we spill all the tea on your favorite reality TV shows, celebrity gossip, and everything in between. We're here to bring you our unfiltered opinions, hilarious commentary, and plenty of laughs along the way.
We're two SDSU Delta Gamma sisters with a microphone and a whole lot of opinions. Each week, we dive headfirst into the wild world of reality television, from Bravo to all the trash TV you could want. We break down the drama, dissect the latest scandals, and share our thoughts on everything from the jaw-dropping moments to the embarrassing antics.
But that's not all. We're not here to just gossip. We're here to connect with you, the jurors, and share our love of all things pop culture. Whether we're dishing on the latest celebrity breakups, discussing our favorite guilty pleasure movies, or sharing embarrassing stories from our own lives, we promise to keep it real, keep it fun, and keep you coming back for more.
Come judge with us.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Welcome to Our Shelves, a podcast where writers from the legendary feminist publishing house Virago talk about their cultural worlds. We'll be diving into these writers' bookshelves, record collections, and recollections to discover what inspires them. I'm Lucy Scholes, and my guest today is Doreen Cunningham. And actually, now I think about it, diving in is the right word when it comes to Doreen's new book. Doreen is an Irish-British writer who was born in Wales. After studying engineering, she worked briefly in climate-related research at the National Environment Research Council and in storm modelling at Newcastle University before turning to journalism. She has worked for the BBC World Service variously as an international news reporter, editor, producer, and reporter since 2000. In 2020, she won the RSL Giles St Aubyn Award, and the following year, in 2021, was shortlisted for the Eccles Centre and Hay Festival Writers Award. Her first book, Soundings, a memoir that tells the story of how she and her then two-year-old son Max followed migrating whales from Mexico up the west coast of America and Canada and on into the Arctic, has just been published by Virago. Welcome to Our Shelves, Doreen. It's really lovely to have you here today.
Thank you for having me. It's really an honour.
Fascinated to talk about Soundings because it's such an extraordinary memoir. It's out this week, so congratulations.
Thank you.
But that means that many of our listeners won't have had a chance to read it yet. So I was wondering if you could explain a little bit about how the book came about and give us just a taster of the journey that you start therein. Or I suppose I should sort of say journeys, because it's not just a traditional travel memoir. In it, you write about quite a few sort of emotional journeys that you've been on, and you also discuss the climate crisis and the sort of how that has related to your work experience over the years.
Well, it came about when I was stuck at home with baby twins and couldn't go anywhere, and I'm a bit of a wanderer. I do get very itchy feet, and because I couldn't move, I had to do something, and so the book started. And it was actually really lovely to kind of reacquaint myself with the travelling that I'd done with my son when he was two. I couldn't possibly go off with two babies and then an older child, but I was able to relive the journey and my time living in the Arctic with an Inupiaq family, an incredibly special time, a real privilege to have been able to do that. The backbone of the journey is I was living in a hostel for homeless single mothers with my two-year-old, and struggling to do freelance work at night, struggling to earn enough even just to afford to stay there. And I lied to get a bank loan and went off to follow the grey whale migration. I kind of read about them one night when I was in the hostel and was so inspired by their endurance. They're not a species I'd known anything about because they're not particularly, in some ways, charismatic. They don't jump around like humpbacks and they're not giant like blues and they're kind of grey, a bit knobbly and barnacled. But what I read was that if you go to a particular place in Baja California in Mexico, they will come up and play with the boats. And sometimes they're called friendlies. It's a really strange phenomenon because these are lagoons where the whales have actually been slaughtered en masse by whalers in the past, but they have displayed kind of a behavioral plasticity, which is also really interesting because part of what makes them such incredible, fascinating animals is that they are so flexible in how they behave. And they show for me what was so inspiring, as well as the endurance of this incredible migration where they travel up to the Arctic and back. They feed in the Arctic, they give birth in Mexico. And so they're kind of doing this journey every year, the mothers with their calves. And that, you know, that was very appealing as a single parent. I was like, well, they can do it, I can do it, let's go and see them. But also they have survived previous climate change. They survived through the ice ages, probably because they are so flexible on what they eat. You know, they've showed massive resilience and adaptivity, and I find that very inspiring too. The backbone of the book is that journey, traveling from Baja, California, all the way up the West Coast to the Arctic. But then that is interwoven with an earlier journey I did before becoming a mum, when I was working as a journalist. And I traveled to the Arctic, to Utqiagvik, which is the most northerly town in Alaska. And it's the home of the Inupiaq people. And I had gone there to record eyewitness accounts of climate change. And I was so welcomed, so taken, so drawn into that community by a particular family who opened their doors to me and lived there for a while, and had the most wonderful experience, but also saw how climate change was impacting very deeply on that culture and community. When I gave birth to my twins, I suppose I was in a bubble for a while and I hadn't quite realised where we were with the science of climate. I wasn't working in journalism for a time and I took a break to look after the babies. Then, you know, Extinction Rebellion happened and I took a good look, was devastated to see that actually what we're talking about is an unfolding in my lifetime, in my children's lifetime. And as a mother, it's very hard to know what to do. I felt very responsible. I felt a huge amount of grief. And that also powered me through putting this book together while I had very young children. It's an act of activism. I feel like the general public have been sidelined, have not been given the information about what's happening. Mothers particularly, and carers, you know, don't know what's happening, don't understand what's happening, and don't understand how it's all interlinked. If I could miss it, then I think a lot of people will have missed it. You know, I'd worked in climate science. I was already devoting my life to it as much as I could. And I had taken my eye off the ball. And, you know, I think that actually the scientific models were very conservative, and also it was very tempting to believe the skeptics. Of course, it was a much lovelier experience to listen to someone who's being funny and jocular and making fun of people who are talking about very difficult things. So basically the book is me trying to carry that story in a way that's accessible, to really celebrate and inspire the stories of the people and the animals that I spent time with during those journeys, how wonderful it was and how wonderful it is being a mum, to try and carry all of it.
Well, I think you pulled it off beautifully. It's a wonderful story of endurance on so many levels. Like, I love the way that the sort of endurance of the whales that you're talking about and the way that they make this migration with their calves each year and the way that they keep going despite such kind of changes in the climate in which they live over the years, obviously. And then there's you and Max making this journey, which is quite problematic at times and really quite hard for you to do. I'd love to know a little bit more just about the writing process. It must have been incredibly emotional, not only to kind of go back and relive these moments in your life, which, without wanting to give too much away, but there's some really kind of, you know, heart-wrenching stuff that goes on here. Some of your relationships with the people that you met and obviously your relationship with Max along the way, but sort of bringing together a story that is very personal to you, that has all these resonances with the wider world. How did it feel putting it down on paper? Was it a sort of cathartic experience in that classic way that people talk about, or was it actually quite hard to do?
It wasn't cathartic. It was very hard, and I wouldn't have done it except I did something called Novel in a Year, which is run by someone called Andrea Mason, where she gives you deadlines. I basically paid to get some deadlines to get some stuff out. It was just, the story was so obvious, you know, the structure of the book was so obvious in terms of the journey. So I'd never written anything like that before. I'd written as a journalist, but that was always very short news pieces, and I was mainly presenting radio, so it was extremely factual and very quick. So I had no experience. And then I actually did an MA, on which I did none of the reading, but all of the workshops, and just produced a lot of stuff. And I think that what that did is it gave me confidence, because I had no confidence that I could write a book, and also no confidence that I could do it well, particularly when writing about a tribe that I'm not part of. And I got a lot of feedback. I checked in a lot of times with people in the community, but also writers on the course. I was really at a very early stage, really encouraged by Diana Evans, who I had a workshop with, and she said, "Your writing about race is really intelligent." And I think if I hadn't heard that at an early stage, I wouldn't have the confidence to carry on. And it was all really important encouragement. So I just couldn't have done it without a community around me saying, "Oh, I like that. Yeah, carry on." And then by the end, I had a kind of vaguely shaped thing to send off, so it was very rushed, actually.
And the family that you stayed with up in the Arctic on your first visit, who, you like you say, you become very close to, and in the book you keep in touch with over the years after you've left, and then you go and revisit them again. I'm fascinated, maybe this is quite a personal question, but have they read the book? Have you sort of, I presume obviously you kind of told them you were writing about it, and how was that?
Yes, they knew from the beginning I was writing about it. The Julia, the kind of main character in the book, knows about it. Also some of the other family members. Julia herself didn't read it, but another family member read all the parts about the community. And I also got someone else in the community who wasn't part of the family, but who, you know, perhaps wouldn't be as distracted by the personal relationships, just to read it from a community point of view to see if there was anything that they were worried about. I would not have published without having done that.
Yeah, it's beautiful. Well, it's absolutely beautiful, I think. And it's a real testament as well to what you can achieve, I think, as a mother. People, there's a lot of talk about how to balance kind of work and motherhood. There's a lot of talk about how to write when you're a mother. And the very fact that you took this incredible journey when you know, Max was still so young, but then the idea that you wrote it after you had kind of young twins as well on top of that, I'm incredibly impressed. So well done.
Thank you. Well, it wasn't easy. It wasn't easy financially either. Yeah. I mean, during the writing, we were actually still living on food bank donations. So it was, I really wanted to do it.
Well, I think it's an incredible achievement. And I just can't wait for our listeners to read it. It's wonderful. If you know, I knew nothing about grey whales going into it. I knew nothing about life in the Arctic. And I learned so much, but I also found it. It's really beautifully kind of written narrative nonfiction as well. I think the story is stunning. So thank you.
Well, thank you so much.
Well, let's get into some of our main questions now. We're going to talk about some books that you've been reading recently, Doreen. Could you tell me about a couple of books that are currently on your bedside table, please?
I've wanted to read this particular book that I'm reading at the moment for years. I haven't had time to get around to it, and I'm really enjoying it. It's Braiding Sweetgrass by Robin Wall Kimmerer, citizen of the Potawatomi Nation. And she is both a very distinguished professor and also writes from her wisdom as a Native American person who understands plants as part of her cultural heritage. And I've only read the first few chapters, but there's so much to take in. It's so complex and so beautifully written that I'm going to take my time over it. What I love immediately about it is the way that it explains the wisdom of plants and makes them basically into people with agency from whom we can learn. Mm. And in the first chapter, she talks about what she calls the Council of Pecans, the pecan tree, the nut tree.
Right.
And she tells a story of her own grandfather as a child out gathering nuts with his friends. In a year when the trees are fruiting, and nut trees don't do this all the time, they build up their reserves and then fruit very dramatically all together in the same year. And you can't really tell when that's going to be. And the elders used to say that they stood in council and discussed it and talked about it and then decided. And the effect is that they outwit the squirrels, because when they all fruit together, there's tons and tons of nuts, and the squirrels can't possibly eat them all. And so some will survive and grow into new trees. And then during the time when they don't fruit, the squirrels kind of have to go somewhere else, find other food, get eaten by hawks and foxes, and there are fewer of them. And so the idea is that the trees kind of have a chat and say, oh, look, not too many squirrels around, let's go for it. And of course, the idea that trees could communicate was poo-pooed by science for a very long time. But, you know, with her botanist hat on, she can explain that we know now that they do communicate by pheromones, which are sort of like hormones carried on the wind, and that it's perfectly possible that there is a sort of tree council going on. But then she talks about her people. Not only were they kind of forcibly relocated multiple times, but in the end they were offered land as individuals with the promise of never being moved again.
Okay.
So that broke this communal relationship with the land, which was so important culturally. And then she goes back to the pecans and she offers their lesson, which is to make decisions in community and to seek community. And she talks about people gathering now and, you know, renewing and re-strengthening ties, talking about how the trees stick together and how important that is.
That sounds absolutely fascinating. And it's a book that I've heard of, but not one that I've sort of come around to reading. But I love that idea of actually not just braiding together those stories of the sort of, you know, the what we might think of as the myths or the stories that kind of hold sway in the community, but also then showing that they are backed up by science. What a strange and kind of incredible thing to do.
Yes, it's a real celebration of her culture. And another aspect that really interests me is she goes on to talk about the grammar of her own language and how it differs from English, in that our language shapes our worldview. And in most indigenous languages, including Inuit languages and the Inupiaq language, which I'm obviously interested in and which features in my book, there is no word for it. And so obviously, if you called a person it, that would be offensive. And in these languages, in our language, you know, if I called you it, that wouldn't be very nice. And in their own languages, the same word is used to address all the living world. So you would address the same word is used to address your family as all other life, and not just life, actually. Rocks are addressed as animate as well, because the living world is regarded as family. And I love that. I mean, that's the world that I would like to live in, one where we talk about and treat other living things with respect and as relations. I think that's a really beautiful concept for a language to hold. And in soundings, I often use the Inupiaq words that I was taught when I'm describing animals. So Arvik, the bowhead whale, is a major character in the book, and I wanted the reader to appreciate it through the Inupiaq word, because we have bowhead, which refers to the shape of the jaw, and there's balaena mysticetus, which is the Latin word, which kind of implies the Linnaean classification and a hierarchy of life. But I want the readers to see the whale as a relative, to really care about the whales.
Oh, and what's the second book you're going to tell us about today, Doreen?
Well, this book is called The Marrow Thieves, and it's by a young Métis author, Cherie Demiline, and it's a young adult book. This book is simply stunning. The narrator is a young boy. He has a very strong voice, which absolutely held my attention. And the story is devastating, but it's also humorous. And what comes through is an incredible sense of community and fierceness and strength in these characters. It basically is the story of attempted genocide of Indigenous Americans. It's set in the future, although as you read it, you are reminded continually that this has actually happened.
Right.
So the characters are on the run constantly throughout the book. And Cherie Demiline, when she talks in interviews, mentions that as kind of being a parallel to the constant threat of loss that these communities feel, in a contemporary way. They're trying the mad dash towards regaining or reclaiming what they had, is how she describes it, which exists for Native people and which mirrors what she's done in the book. And she herself was from a community that was relocated twice. And so this story is different from what happened, but it's also the same. And the premise is that Indigenous people are being hunted for their bone marrow because it holds their dreams.
Wow.
But the story, that's fantastical, obviously. But the story is so believable because although that premise is different, what happens is very firmly based in reality, in what has already happened historically. And I've listened to her do interviews, and also the world that she has built in the book is very firmly based in reality. She used NASA projections on climate change to think about how she was going to portray the landscape that these people are fleeing through. So cities on the coast have crumbled, the earth is devastated, there's near constant rain, and there's been a massive migration inland. It's absolutely awful, but it's very, very believable, which is the stunning thing about it. I think she's a genius.
It makes me think of that thing about speculative fiction. The best speculative fiction is always that's based in reality, right? Like, it's not the way that Margaret Atwood talks about The Handmaid's Tale as having everything in that book has happened in some form in our history. We just, we might not be aware of it, right?
Right, yeah. So you're being told about things, but you're not being lectured or told off. You're being quite gently reminded. It's a really beautiful way of doing it.
And how did you first come across her?
How did I first come across her? I don't know.
Is it because the topic is something you're interested in?
No, I think it's more that I like reading books by Indigenous authors. So okay. I probably came across her before I came across her book.
And next up, you're going to tell me about a couple of articles that you read recently that have made you think.
Yeah, that's right. I read an article by the author of Made. She's an American writer, and that's, of course, been made into a really interesting Netflix series. And what I liked about that was it was very helpful to read that article. I've also got that book sitting there ready to read. I've got a bit of a pile. I don't know when I'll get to that one. But it was the way that she acknowledged the PTSD that stays with you after you've experienced real financial insecurity or not having a home with a child. The title of the article is "I Left Poverty After Writing Maid, But Poverty Never Left Me." And she also found it difficult to kind of, her life has turned out very well. The book was part of that. It's really helped her. And she's in a very secure and happy situation now. But there's a line somewhere in the article where she talks about, socializing people who would have been her clients that she would have been cleaning for, and the sort of discomfort that she feels. And also, she very perceptively and interestingly mentions that she knows that her story is one that is very palatable because she's white. She's educated. She ended up getting a degree, and she's made it out of poverty. And that's a little bit discomforting or very discomforting. And people tell her, oh, you deserve this, you know, this is great. And she's like, well, everyone deserves this. And we really need to sit with the stories of people who haven't made it out.
Mm.
And people who are, you know, more affected by poverty, different communities, and look at inequality.
Do you think this resonated particularly with you because of your own experiences? I mean, you talked briefly earlier about how when you were writing Soundings, you know, you were living off food stamps for some of it. And you obviously talk in the book about living in the hostel with Max when he was quite young. And that's clearly something, you know, that sort of stuff doesn't go away overnight, obviously. And I can imagine that there might be a sort of... one could have a similar response to say, well, you know, Doreen's written this incredible book. She's clearly quite successful now. That sort of life is behind her. But it's not that easy, I presume.
No, it's not. And I think that the pandemic has been really difficult for very, very many people. But for mothers and carers, they've kind of disappeared from view, haven't they?
Yeah.
I'm an unpaid carer. One of my children has a disability. And so that adds an extra dimension. And yeah, it was just really lovely to read this very articulate young woman writing about it and to have it acknowledged that the experiences stay.
And the second article that you told me you've been reading is something a little bit different. It's closer to a different aspects of Soundings, isn't it?
Yes. So this is the most incredible writer, Bathsheba DeMuth. She's a professor, an American professor, and she also writes about Wales. And I also have her book waiting to be read. She has written a book called The Floating Coast, An Environmental History of the Bering Strait, which I hope to be able to read very soon. And her writing is absolutely exquisite. Her article, she's done in an article, I feel, what I try to do in my entire book. She's just so precise with her language. And what I really love is the beginning of the article where she says, she describes a grey whale calf being born and she makes it a she. So she immediately gives it a character and a kind of personhood. And she says that before a grey whale becomes a home or a barrel of oil or a metaphor, before she enters the realm of human meaning, she is a being complete in herself. And oh my God, I love that sentence, because there's part of me which really objects to whales being used as metaphors.
Mm.
They're not metaphors. They're beings and they have communities and lives, as do all other living things on the planet. And perhaps if we weren't so concerned about, you know, using them as metaphors, we might actually think a little bit more about how our consumption is affecting them. I just love how she's able to take these ideas and make them so beautiful.
It's a beautiful article. It was something I had sort of missed. I hadn't seen it before and then read it in advance of talking to you today. And it, some of the imagery has really stayed with me. I'm kind of fascinated to ask, though, what's your relationship since writing Soundings? Are you thrilled when you come across other work that's about whales like this, you know, particularly if it's very beautifully written or if it's very informative? Or do you feel like people are stepping on your toes and it's your sort of area of expertise now?
Oh my God, no, I'm so thrilled, but particularly by Bathsheba DeMuth, because everything she writes is so astounding. And no, the thing is, I don't feel like I'm an expert at all. And I should just say, I have only just finished writing Soundings, so I haven't had time to read very much at all for several years. But I can't not read things when she writes them, and she would be the expert, not me. She spent a huge amount of time up in the Russian Arctic with Yupik whalers, who are related to the Inupiaq, but on the Russian side. No, I find her writing very inspiring.
Brilliant. Arshel's be back in just a moment.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Welcome back to Our Shelves. I'm Lucy Scholes, and I'm talking to Doreen Cunningham about how exciting she finds it when she comes across other brilliant writers working on the same subject as her. Next up, Doreen, could you tell me a bit about a book that has made you think about feminism in a new way?
I have recently started reading All About Love by Bell Hooks, and what I loved about this book is how accessible it makes the ideas. Again, this is a very eminent academic writing about feminism, and in the first few chapters she looks at our definitions of love and how faulted they are, and how it seems to me revolutionary it would be to just look at the word properly. She's broken it down into components through research, or kind of drawing on other people's research, and the message is quite simple really, but it's very much that love is a verb. And there are components to it. It's not a fluffy romantic feeling that happens to you. It's a way of behaving in the world, a choice, and it's not romantic. And what I found quite freeing was the way she defines it. She has a list, which are care, affection, recognition, respect, commitment, trust, and honest and open communication. And she says that without those aspects, it's not love. And I actually really liked this. And what she ends up saying is that love and abuse cannot coexist. And that many people cling to a notion of love which makes bad behavior or abuse acceptable because they want to believe that they are loved. And I can see that it could be difficult to own the fact that actually what you're experiencing in a relationship is not love. But you can still say, you know, you can say there was, she talks about a relationship actually she had where there was care and there were other things, but in the end it wasn't love. And I just find that terribly freeing, and I guess it's a very good basis for healthy relationships, you know, for feminism. And it's a foundation stone, isn't it, for how we relate to each other. And I really enjoyed looking at that.
It's so fascinating. This is the second time that somebody's chosen All About Love as a book that, you know, for the answer to this question. I think it was Anne Friedman in our very first season who also talked about it. I'm really fascinated to know, how did you come across this? Was it a recommendation? Did somebody make a recommendation to you? Was it a book that has been on your shelf for a while? Like how and why were you reading this particular book recently?
I was reading this book because I knew I was going to have to talk about feminism to you. And I had asked my neighbours,
that's probably the best answer yet,
if they had any good books. And I got lent this one. So it's been lent to me by a neighbour.
Oh, that's really interesting. And then actually you found it quite fascinating to read.
Oh, it's absolutely lovely. Yeah, it's really strengthening.
Had you read Bell Hooks before?
No. No, I haven't actually read many books. I'm not a big, you know, I don't have the time to think about things. I haven't read books on feminism since I was very young, since way before I was a mum. You know, I went into science, and social sciences is not my area. So what I tend to talk about and think about are the sciences and my life experience. And so it was actually really lovely to go back and to look at this. I knew of her, but I had never actually dived into a book before.
Oh, well, I sort of feel like then I felt a bit bad about asking you, making you do extra homework, as it were. But then if you've enjoyed the experience, that's a good sign.
Yeah, no, it's been good.
And last up today, Doreen, if I may, could you tell me about a woman or a person of an unrepresented gender whom you particularly admire?
Well, I'm going to give you two, because I want to give you a whale. First up, I'm going to give you a whale. And she is called Earhart, this whale, and she features in soundings. She lives in the northern waters of Puget Sound. She is a grey whale mother, so she does this incredible migration from Mexico to the Arctic with her calves when she has them. But what she's done in Puget Sound is really quite astounding. She is the founder, a marine biologist there, John Kalambakidis, a really renowned whale expert, first spotted her in 1990, and he has seen other whales following her. And she has found a new food source where they go into quite a risky area in the intertidal zone and suck up shrimp, ghost shrimp near the shore. It's not what grey whales usually feed on. And this is a sign of adaptation. This is almost an emergency food bank for whales if they're not getting enough of what they need to eat in the Arctic. And so she is a pioneer. I think about those grey whale mothers a lot, you know, their endurance and what they're doing. And she's really doing something quite spectacular for her whole species, as are many other grey whales, I'm sure. So first of all, you get your whale, but I will give you a person as well, a human, should I say. Angela Davis, the legendary, again, academic, Black American academic, who has been so active on talking and educating people about the prison system, and who in 1970 faced three death penalties. The whole apparatus of the state was set up against Angela Davis because she was such a clear thinker and was seeing straight through how the prison system was basically being weaponized against Black communities. And she says in her interviews, you know, Richard Nixon was the president, Ronald Reagan was the governor of California. She was represented by the FBI as being armed and dangerous, and they meant to send her to the death chamber to make a point. And this was a time when they were attacking Black leaders, either assassinating them or exiling them, you know, trying to destroy the Black leadership. And she managed to mobilize a response that basically got her freed. Aretha Franklin offered to pay her bail, although unfortunately when it needed to happen and there was a very short window when she could actually be freed, Aretha Franklin was in the Caribbean and couldn't be reached in this time when communications were a lot more difficult. And a white farmer then put up his farm as bail in order to get her out until Aretha Franklin came back into communication. And so there was this big effort formed around her. But she, Angela Davis, when she's speaking now, she speaks about environmental justice and climate change. Mm. And she emphasizes how, first and foremost, climate change affects every facet of social justice. It's ground zero of social injustice. And she has said, quote, "If we don't manage to save this planet, then it makes little sense to be involved in all the other struggles that we face." So when I think of her, I think of her incredible bravery and her incredible brain. I like to think about her as well as Earhart the whale.
That's such a beautiful kind of place to end the episode, I think, particularly because I was, after reading Soundings, I was so intrigued to know, in a way, how much of those sort of whales, how much of them stays with you over the years, how much of their kind of lives are you still thinking about? And clearly by choosing Earhart, that's a proof positive that they're always with you. Thank you so much for listening. Our Shells was brought to you by the team at Virago Press. Special thanks to today's guest, Doreen Cunningham, and tune in next time for more conversation about books, feminism, and culture.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.